hearts, when all questions will be answered. So I'm going to get yourself comfortable first of all, and then we'll see what's in the box today. Actually, not that many. Okay, so let us begin. I'll pick one from the middle first of all, at random. Dear Ajahn Brahm, it was because uncontrollable impulse I started during this retreat. I started a short, useless conversation with female yogis during this retreat. Later, that I felt regret and guilt about it towards my action. I hereby would like to seek her pardon if I've been disturbed her. And thanks for... She didn't hiss me away on that occasion. Thanks for your kindness. I also like to seek forgiveness from Ajahn Brahm for this unrightful action. At this point, I hope Ajahn Brahm could teach me how could I restrain my senses towards women. Thank you for the benefit of my spiritual path. Of course, I'm the expert on restraining my senses to the opposite gender. 44 years as a monk. I'm a bit. So, yes. The other person always goes, shh. Because, so it's not an appropriate thing to do during the retreat. But people make mistakes. And if they make mistakes, it's just you bring it up. You tell people. And then afterwards you just ask forgiveness and learn not to do it again. That's all. Be more mindful. I was telling somebody today that uncontrollable impulses, they're not uncontrollable. It's just you haven't learned how to control them yet. So one of the similes which I developed when I was staying in Thailand, in the jungles, where there were so many dangerous snakes. Do you like snakes? You don't? Aww. They're nice and cute. But anyway, they are dangerous sometimes, especially if you step on them. They're not so dangerous if you urinate on them, like I said the other day. Especially if you're a monk, and then it's like holy water. But and people told me, they used to say in that part of Thailand there were 100 different species of snake. 99 of those species were venomous. In other words, if they bit you, you're in big trouble. And the last species of snake, if they weren't venomous, but they'd usually strangle you to death. In other words, they were all very, very deadly. So you had to be very careful of snakes. I was never ever bitten by a snake because I had loving kindness towards them. Stepped on them once, but I just managed to see this. What a big snake had come into my hut. And I jumped one way, and the poor little snake jumped the other way. And you can see that he was really frightened. And so he just said, oh, come on, snake, you can go out that way. And of course the snake went out. Over in Australia once, there's this huge tiger snake. Because I was on my 6 month retreat when I never talked to anybody for 6 months. But I talked to the tiger snake, came and kept me company. It was huge, it was 2.4 meters long. Oh, sorry, no, that's a mistake. 2.7 meters long. Because I missed it, because it was stretched in the shade of one of my kuti. And I built that kuti, so I know sort of how much it is on the outside with the bricks. A really big snake. But I was just washing my boat. It was a really hot day. And all the snake wanted was a bit of cool. And to shade. So I was washing my bowl, and the snake came. He looked at me, and I looked at him. Well, you can use the shade of my hut, it's okay. And I just carried on washing my bowl. And then the next thing, I turned around. I wasn't paying any attention to him. He'd actually turned around to take the shade in the hut. He was now checking me out, first of all. Is this monk okay? And of course I was. And he had his tail pointed towards me. and his head was just the other way. So, you know, to me that showed he was very trusting. So, we never had any monks being bitten by snakes, or any lay people being bitten by snakes over in Bodhinyana Monastery. Well, I remember this was after I left, after Ajahn Chah got really sick, that there was one Singaporean monk got bitten by a snake over, it's an interesting story, got bitten by a snake over in Wat Nanachat in Thailand. And so he was bitten by a snake, and then he went into the office, and there's another monk in the library. He said, "Now, where's the snake book?" He said, "Oh, just up there." And so he picked up the snake book. He was looking at the Singaporean monk looking through the snake book. He thought, "Oh, my goodness, that's the one which just bit me, and it's deadly." And the other monk, "Well, that one." And he could see the wound, you know, the two puncture marks, and it was swelling up. And so the other monk, you know, "Wow, I better go and get somebody." And somebody asked me, "Can monks run?" Yes, they can. when they have to get some help. So he ran into the village. There's no telephone. Ran to the village. And so he didn't get the doctor, the medic. He got what, you know, the commoners call like the witch doctor. The fellow, because this man in the village, I heard about him when I was a monk. In that village, in Bong Wai village, if ever any of you have gone there, they threw away all the anti-venom. Because this fellow had a chant, a gata, a magic chant, which he said, you know, actually cured a snake bite. And many people had snake bite, and this thing worked. So he brought in the spirit doctor, witch doctor, I don't know what you call him, but you know, who had some chanting, layman. And the layman came in there, took a look at all this, it's serious. So, in front of this Singaporean, highly educated, you know, this Thai man started doing his chanting, and he chewed something in his mouth, and spat it onto the wound, did some more chanting. Now imagine that was you. This poor Singapore fellow, you know, just bitten by a deadly snake. He turned around to the other monks and asked, now, very sort of humbly and politely, "Can I have a proper doctor, please?" But, you know, his proper doctors were too far away. So he was doing the and chanting. And the monks there, they said, just the swelling went down and the wound closed. And he was fine. And it was one of those magic stuff, which, you know, sometimes I wasn't there to see it, but I know there are other people who saw it. And so, yeah, this is sometimes the magic stuff which they have. So if I had a chant like that, would you? Would you trust me? If you got... Oh, would you say, "Get a doctor!" So sometimes some of the things you see in this world are just really quite strange. But anyway, the simile of the snake is that because in the evening time, on the early morning, there were so many snakes around the forest monasteries. Now, after I finished, and the shoes I had, I was big Birkenstocks now, but in those days, sometimes you didn't have any shoes. You had sandals, and they soon fell apart. You tried to fix them up with string and all sorts of stuff, but it was really poor, so sometimes you didn't have any shoes. So you had to walk, you know, on the bare sand at night time when there were snakes around. So, but what I did, it was mindfulness. I said to myself, when I left the hall to go back to my hut, or leaving my hut to go to the hall, there were snakes around. They're not malicious or vicious, but, you know, if you step on them, what do you expect? They might bite you. So, I said, I'm going to be on the lookout for snakes. I'll be mindful. I'm prepared, looking out for them. So that meant I wasn't just going down the path, thinking of the meaning of life, or thinking of just, you know, of songs or old girlfriends or anything like that. I was really on the lookout. I was very mindful. If I saw a shadow across the path, it could be a twig, it could be just some moonlight against a sapling, I wouldn't give a second thought, I would just turn back and go another route. If there was no other route, I would jump over that snake, because you didn't know that could be a snake. Most times it wasn't. Most a stick or just a shadow of that sort, but I had to make sure I would see that snake before it got me. And that's the way I avoided those dangers. The same way, if you have a danger on a retreat, it's one of the precepts you're going to find it very difficult to keep, then psych your mind up, program your mind. I've got to be careful of lust or anger or just greed or whatever, and you put that into your mind. I'm going to be on the lookout for this. So that but when you see it coming, you catch it beforehand and you avoid it. Or another story similar, it was, I'm not sure if you ever knew this monk a long time ago, Ajahn Anando. He was a monk with me over in Wat Nanachat, and he was in the United States, and a veteran US Marine, and he'd been in the Vietnam War. And while he was in the Vietnam War, he was laughing at one of his friends when a bullet shot him in the back of the head. He got hit by a Viet Cong bullet. And, you know, just fortunately he was evacuated in time to save his life. But when he woke up in the Marine hospital, a field hospital, the doctor said, "You're a Marine, you're a tough guy. Sort of just tell you that you're going to be blind, because we had to do surgery on your brain and move that part of the brain which is to do with sight." And he told me, and I got no doubt about it, he was a very good friend, he said, "Look, if I was blind, I'd already figured out how I was going to kill myself. You know, I was a Marine. He was in a gang before in Buffalo, New York. Really sort of bad guy before he got shot in the back of the head. And so he decided to kill himself, but when the bandages were taken off, he could see. And no one knew why, but no, he could see. And he was just so high, so energized." But I think, did I tell this story over in the PGF? No, it must have been in Penang. But before I go on to the main part of the story, that he was put on a veteran's pension, you know, of significant injury, $1,000 a month. And that was in 1969, 1970. It's a lot of money. And so he was just, didn't need to work, enjoying himself. And he was playing baseball one day with his friends. And the batsman hit the ball high in the air, in his direction. It's a very easy catch. Except when he was following the ball through the air, the ball vanished. It just disappeared out of the universe. And then it appeared back again. And that was how he realized he had a blind spot in his vision. And he described what it was like, having a blind spot. There was part of his vision was just not registering any sights. But his brain filled in what it thought should be there. So if there was clouds in the sky, his brain, instead of seeing a black hole or something, would actually paint in the clouds. If there was a building, the brain would actually fill in the missing pieces. And the brain had deceived him for many months. But once a ball was flying through the air, the brain couldn't work out the trajectory, so it just disappeared. The sky was still there because the brain had imagined what was actually there, what it thought should be there. He said, "Most curious thing in the world, having a blind spot, because for months you can't see it. That's why it's blind." Now, I've used that simile for, you know, illusion. Awija, delusion. The thing with delusion, you just can't see it's there. You've got a blind spot. And only because when things happen which shouldn't happen, you realize, oh my goodness, that's what I couldn't see for years. A blind spot. But anyway, later on, when he moved to England, he started to get epileptic fits. And because of the brain injury. And so the only way he could deal with that problem was using his mindfulness. Just like the snake simile. You know, once the epileptic fit, you know, was going, he just couldn't do anything. He was just totally out of control. And it was, you know, very unpleasant. And especially just very worrying for everybody else. And fortunately he survived them all. But then he decided that the only way that he could cope as a monk was actually being so mindful he could see the causes of that epileptic fit. You know, trace it back. You know, he knew this particular tension, tightness, or the vision was starting to go a bit strange. That was the lead up to an epileptic fit. And many times he knew something was happening and it just happened. But then he started going further back, catching it earlier and earlier and earlier and earlier and earlier and earlier. Until he could catch it so early that he said, if I keep carrying on, I know that this will happen next, and that will happen, and that will happen, and I will have the fit. But what he did was catch it so early, he could do something else. Take another course of action, which was usually going to his room in the darkness, laying down and meditating, relaxing. And he didn't have any epileptic fits after that. So, it's interesting how he used mindfulness to really understand just the whole process, you know, of the epilepsy, and to see the signs earlier and earlier and earlier until he could avoid it. It's just like, you know, if you have any problems, a snake, you see it before it catches you. If it's, you know, like the bad habitual speech, catch it before it gets you, and then you can always do something else. Anyway, to Ajahn Brahm, we talked a lot about letting go. However, sometimes it is difficult to let go, even if you want to let go. Could you share more concrete techniques how best to let go? I've already told you the technique about letting go of your past by writing it down. I said that over. No, come on, I must have done it. I think in the BGF. Because it's a standard psychology technique. You go to the therapist, the first thing you have to do, if there's something really bothering you, hurting you, which has really made your life a misery, you really have to, you know, really bring it up first of all. Suppressing it, pretending it didn't happen, hiding it, doesn't help at all. So often, they ask you, well, now you're in a safe space, let me know what happened in detail. It takes a lot to actually to tell somebody else, you know, embarrassing, terrible things you've done, or sort of relive what other people have done to you. But instead of telling them, sometimes the easier way is just writing it down. Now all that trauma, all that terrible things, the things you feel guilty about, whatever it is, write it down. Now, where Ajahn Brahm steps in is the type of paper you write it down on. And number two, the type of ink you use. I remember now I told this at the Triple Wisdom Hall over in Penang. And I thought it was very funny, but I had to tell them, please, 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 don't do that in this temple, otherwise we'll block all the toilets and we'll never be invited back again. Because what you do, toilet paper is very cheap. A whole roll, so inexpensive. And then you start, brown felt tip pen is the best. Dark brown. And you start writing all these very bad memories of the terrible things, some of which you're responsible for. You did it, write it down there. Or what other people did to you. You write it all down there. As clear as possible, in detail, you've got plenty of ink, plenty of paper, you write it all down bit by bit by bit. And as you write it down nice and clearly, do you make the psychological subconscious connection? It's called association with the other dark brown matter which goes on toilet paper. And because you're making that association, it's dark brown, yucky stuff. Because of that, you realize once you've written it all down, this is not something you should keep. How many of you are concerned for climate change? Who want to save the forests? who make use of paper and recycle it. But even Richard Attenborough, even the head of the World Wildlife Fund, even the president of Greenpeace, they never use both sides of the toilet paper. What a waste. What hypocrites. They waste half of it. And even worse, sometimes when you wipe your bottom, there's only a tiny bit of brown stuff on it. Can't they fold it up, put it in their pocket to use for later? And of course, no one does that. Even a small amount, there's lots of space left, lots of white space left, let alone the other side. You throw it in the toilet and flush it away. No one keeps anything, any toilet paper with even a slight bit of brown on it. It's a very strong association that if you write down in dark brown ink on your toilet paper all the terrible things which you have done, or the things which other people have done to you, you write it down, the association, I've been carrying this around, what an idiot, what a stinky, smelly, dirty habit that is, to keep the rubbish of the past. And then, once you've done that, you've read it and realized this is not something you should keep, then you have to do the final ceremony. And there is a temple to do that in. And it's it's called the toilet cubicle. But you don't sit on the throne yet. Oh, you may do, but if you sit on the throne, you have to read it to yourself again, first of all. Read it slowly. No speed reading. It's really got to sink into you. This is dirty, stinky stuff, on dark brown ink, on toilet paper. Don't know whose fault it was. Your fault, other people's fault, your boss's fault, or whatever. You read it out. And once you've read it out and realized that this you've been keeping for such a long time, then you stand up, put it in the bowl, and you do the ceremony. You can actually do some Buddhist chanting if you like. Anicca Sankhara, impermanent all things. And I will now let go. And you press that amazing button on the top. And it goes out of your life forever. Who would want to keep memories which were stinky as feces? No one would. Except you. So, sometimes, say letting go, it's easy to letting go, but sometimes a ceremony is helpful. And it's not just a joke. Many people have done that. And just, they do it because, it's easy to remember, it's funny, but it's also really meaningful. You read it, put it all down, and you realize, wow, I've been carrying this, and this is dirty stuff, filthy stuff. It's not the sort of stuff a human being should keep. And then you put it in the toilet bowl, flush it. The actions, when done mindfully, with the associations, understanding why you're doing that, is a ceremony which reinforces and strengthens the act of letting go. And many times people say it works. It just frees you with that strong association. So that's one way of letting go, which is very, very helpful. I know Ajahn Chah used to say, I've told you this before, when I was with him, he would stop by the side of the road, pick up a stick, how heavy is this? And before I could answer, throw it away. And so I'd ask people to do that first of all. Put all your bad memories on a piece of stick and throw it in the forest. And then I was polluting the forest because people had so many bad memories. So the toilet paper one is a much more appropriate one for you. Just wanted to know the Buddhist view on gambling and gambling as a livelihood. The five precepts didn't include gambling, but a quick check with Google, did mention that the suttas did disallow both recreational gambling as a livelihood, What if I work for Genting Casino? This is, it depends where you work. There are some people, they work there, but they just clean the toilets. Because many of the people from here won't do that ceremony down here, so they go up on the cable and go up and do their letting go up the top there. It depends what you're working at. Should I quit and join a more wholesome industry instead? What if I'm a professional poker player but vow to donate 90% of my tournament winnings to Bodhidharma Monastery or the BGF? But what if you lose? Does that mean that Bodhidharma Monastery has to pay your debts or the BGF? And so I keep 10% for my frugal sustenance. You know, Ajahn, the Christians only donate 10% of their earnings to the church. That's what they're supposed to do. That's pre-tax. 10%. But anyway. Jokes aside, I just wanted to know how all this adds up to the great big karmic book. Thank you. They call in the suttas gambling a pathway to trouble. Abhayamukha. Basically for really bad states. Because, you know, you see what happens. You know, where does that money come from to all that great food up there, which is very cheap, or to get musicians or singers or stand-up comedians or even sit-down comedians. And it's, you know, silly people's money. So people always think they can win, but they never do. The problem is that sometimes people come to, like, a temple, first of all, a lucky temple, and they do some chanting or something, because they think if they go to a lucky temple, then afterwards, you know, they may beat the odds. That's what people think. And I shouldn't say this, but sometimes that happens. Because one of my friends, he's getting really old now. Now he was in the British Air Force in Singapore, working as a dental technician. So he was there. They needed all sorts of people, and he met a nice young Singapore girl. They got married, Julie and Gus. And you know that every year she had to come back to see her relations, and they were yakking, and he was bored as ever, you know, didn't know what to do, bored, what should I do? And his brothers-in-law took sympathy on him and said, do you want to come to the race course this afternoon? And just basically anything to get away from yak. So he never liked gambling, but he went there anyway. But before they went to the Singapore Race Turf Club, whatever it was called, the brothers-in-law and Gus, they went to a lucky temple. They didn't tell me where the lucky temple is. That's good, because you can't get it out of me, because I don't know. They went to a lucky temple. When they got in there, they found the place was really dirty. And so they all cleaned it, first of all. And I always think that's really important. If you clean the temple, care for it, wash it, dust it, then obviously if there are any heavenly guardians there, they would like you. So afterwards, they lit their incense, and then they went to the racetrack. You know what happened? They all lost. They lost quite badly. But anyway, so it was a good afternoon for Gus. But the next thing which happened was the weird stuff. That night, Gus had a dream of a horse race. Very vivid, and he did remember the name of the winning horse in his dream. And so, you know, just for, you know, for fun, he's pretty bored, just living with his in-laws for a week or two, that he looked in the Straits Times, the horse racing section, and he looked down, and a horse by that very name was running that day. This is a true story. This is not a joke. This is a true story. So what did he do? He called his brothers-in-law. Hey, we lost yesterday, but I had a dream last night, a clear dream, and the horse, which I dreamt about, is actually running this afternoon. Come to the racetrack. We'll just recoup our losses. And you know what those brothers-in-law say? Look, that was a Singapore temple. We were Singapore citizens. Had no a spirit in a Singapore temple will tell an Ang Mo without setting us. We don't believe him. So because of that, he went to the racetrack alone. He put quite a bit of money on that horse, and it did come in first. It won. And so he got a lot of money back. And when he told his brothers-in-law when he got back home, they were so upset. They were really angry. Oh, yo, these Singapore spirits and Singapore temples, they look after these white people first. Not us. That's really... So I don't think they ever went to that temple again. You can understand, it's really unfair, isn't it? Just, you know, Singapore temple, Singapore spirits. And just, Ang Mo goes there just once, and he wins a lot. But anyway, but the gambling is always very dangerous. So that's why it's good not to do gambling. But it's worse if you're a monk or a nun to do gambling. Because this is another true story. And I don't mind telling you who the culprit was here, because, you know, she was a very well-known nun. Ayakema. And it wasn't sort of, it was just a moment of lack of mindfulness. Because what was happening, that she had finished teaching a retreat in England. And her driver, who I know very well, was taking her in the car to Heathrow Airport, but having some lunch on the way. And I know somebody is taking me to KLIA, Terminal 2, tomorrow, but please don't give me lunch at the casino. It's very cheap up there, probably, but this is what the driver did. There was a little pub on the way to the airport, and they had a nice restaurant, but to enter the restaurant, you had to go through the pub. And in the pub, you know, the British pubs are more like social centres, though they do serve alcohol, so they're not like rowdy and rough. So they took her inside the restaurant, ordered a nice lunch for her, and because, you know, the monks, you know, eat a little bit more, the nuns as well, because they can't eat in the evening, she was finishing off her lunch, and her driver went outside, said, look, I've got a few spare British coins, and it's not enough to change into, I think she was German, Deutschmarks at that time, before the euro zone. So I'm just going to change, you know, a few coins in the slot machine. You know those slot machines? Yeah, what do they call them in Malaysia? Slot machines, okay. So anyway, she's just basically getting rid of a few, you know, £1 coins. And so she put them in, and pulled the handle, went round and round. Of course, nothing happened, and I went in round and round. And she was almost getting rid of all the coins when Ayakema sort of came past. And the driver, the attendant, just put a coin in the slot. And she saw the nun come round and tell the nun, you've got much better karma than I have. You pull the handle. And just a moment of heedlessness, the nun pulled the handle. Shouldn't do that. Shouldn't do that, because absolutely true story, round and round and round and round it went. Jackpot. And all these coins came streaming out onto her robe. Talk about not touching money. The money touched her, not just one coin. I don't know how many hundreds, thousands of pounds came out onto her robe. She didn't know what to do. You know, it didn't have that sort of simile in the suttas or the jatakas. So she was stunned, but so was everybody in the bar, in the pub. You know, to see this strange lady, just one pull and get the jackpot, that was really, really psychic. And as they were stunned, the bartender rang the bell and explained to the nun that it was a tradition. You know how British people are really strong on their traditions? In this pub, whoever wins the jackpot has to buy a round of drinks to everybody who happens to be in the bar at the time. So a Buddhist nun had to buy gin and tonics, double whiskies, tears. So she didn't break just one preset. She broke a whole heap. Which teaches you, if you're a monk or a nun, just don't go near that gambling house. Although, you know, sometimes, you know, as a monk, I don't know why, maybe as a lawyer before, I know all these loopholes. And so, when I was in Hong Kong, they took me to Macau. I know Macau's casinos everywhere. And I said, well, you know, we're raising funds for the Nuns Monastery or Jhana Grove or something. But, you know, I can't go gambling, but I've got this really interesting scheme. Which I won't break my precepts, but I'll make a lot for the Nuns Monastery. And what's that? I said, all I'll do, I'll just stand outside the casino, outside the entrance. Just stand there, not saying anything, because it's tradition, especially in Hong Kong, Macau, if anybody sees a monk as they're going into gambling, it's really bad luck. So I'll be standing outside there, you know, doing what a monk should do, you know, just stopping people gambling. And because there's so many other casinos, I go to the one next door. And sooner or later, somebody, like the doorman or the security there, will see that no one is going into their casino because of me. And I say, well, you know, I'll move to the next casino if you give an adequate donation. And it's worth you losing a lot of money every minute I stand outside here. And then when I move to the next casino, I do the same thing. No one goes to the next casino until they figure it out and they give another donation. And I see there's many casinos I could really clean up without breaking any precepts and doing my job of trying to prevent people from gambling. We'll never let me do that. Well, the other thing I thought of doing, that's your brother, you're crazy monk. But I thought I'd stand outside the casino and just pull my belly out. And no, not yet. It has to be $10 a rub. And again, they think, wow, what a good idea. You make a fortune, but no way. Well, yeah, some good fun. But I never did it. Is it encouraged to set an intention before meditation, or is it better just to be present to whatever arises without first priming our mind? Well, you sort of, you know, at the beginning of the meditation, it doesn't really matter that much if you set a direction. Now you tell yourself, this is my meditation time. It's not a time for thinking about business. It's not a time for thinking about the stock market or family or something. So you just set the boundaries when you start meditating. And once you set those boundaries, it does actually help a little bit. But it's not intention of where you want to be. It's almost like what I don't want to do during this time. It's a restraint, saying no to things. That can be really can help. It's, you know, you call it setting boundaries. That's the gambling one. It's a good story, gambling. Forgive me for the lack of propriety. Now, do I have to forgive you first before I read on? Or let's make my forgiveness conditional on what you're actually going to say. The subject I'm going to raise may seem immature. Back in the real world, there are a lot of opportunities to fart. F-A-R-T. Thank goodness, they don't serve yogurt during the retreat. How to practice my... Oh, Somebody asked me, said, you must read all the questions out because they're all important. And I said, yes. So I've got to keep my promises. Anyway, how to practice mindfulness while farting. Most importantly, how can one be mindful enough to know when it is safe to fart, especially while one is down with diarrhea? A fart may be a leak in disguise. I must say, this is a unique question. I heard that Vemananda got enlightened while lying down to rest. Wouldn't it be great if one can get enlightened as one lets go? It is letting go, isn't it? Just let go. Let one go. Is it okay to use Anatasanya while farting? That way, no one can place the blame on me. There is no one farting, it's just the Rupa Kanda doing its job. Or to quote Usudhi Magga, the fart is, but there is no fart to be found. Who did this? Is it impolite to discriminate against farters? Why should farters... This is it, I can see it later. Sit at the back of the meditation hall. Perhaps everyone should be reminded of Bahia's teaching. In the herd, there will only be the herd. In the smell, there will only be the smell. Can Ajahn please share your profound insights on the art of beatitude? Thank you in advance, yours faithfully, anonymous wayward coward. When people actually sign up for the retreat, do they fill in forms? Can you check the handwriting? We're gonna. I can't blame you because I started it. Oh, this. A little bit of irreverence. During a couple of sittings in this my previous Vipassana retreat, I find it much easier to watch the pain and numbness of my body than my breath, to the extent I feel deep peace and joy. My question is, in my previous Vipassana retreat, I was told by the nun teacher that I should only watch the pain a maximum for 20 seconds and to return my attention to the primary meditation object, rising and falling of the abdomen. Is that the right approach, as it is contradicted with your teaching, I letting go and not rising and falling of abdomen? It's like all teachers, they give general teachings to people in a group like this, but sometimes special teachings to adapt them to your particular circumstances. So if it's working that you feel a deep peace and joy, and you can sustain that peace and joy for a long time, if it works, then maybe give it a try. But always be very careful, because watching pain and numbness, pain is a sign that you've got your body in a difficult position. So maybe it is because, the body is telling you should move. But you may experiment and try it, see what happens. And if you find the pain is getting worse and afterwards you're very tense, then obviously it was in the wrong direction. But if it seems to be working for you, continues to work, then why not? So this is where we experiment with different postures, different meditation techniques, as long as there's some kindness there, kindness and peace. If someone is interested, can I share with he or she the meditation that I learn? Is it safe? As long as you only teach as far as you know. And as far as you, it's not just know, experience. Because if you teach something like that, about to watch the pain, and just to watch the numbness and don't move, sometimes people can misunderstand it. And if they misunderstand it, you get into trouble sometimes, they blame you. But if you know exactly your limits and you teach within those limits, a lot of times within the limits of your own experience, because you can be sure of that because you have personal experience of it. But if you don't share it with others, there's a lack of teachers in this world. So I would say, share as far as you know. And the basic stuff is always pretty safe. Dear Ajahn, you mentioned in your talk that if someone is still scared or afraid to die, there are some more work to be done. Could you explain more? Yeah, what that really means is, scared to die means, you know, if there's like a fire or a snake, you don't test how scared you are to die by putting your finger there. Come on, come on. Bite me, bite me. No, that is not sort of, but you know, if you're really terrified, ah! And sometimes the fear usually just doesn't, is counterproductive. Sometimes the fear alerts your senses, but sometimes the fear makes you overreact. That is why, again, my own experience, that teaching children, that especially math and science, I did have to do some science teaching as well, that we decided, a group of students, to ask, can we please have a GP come in and tell our students, you know, teaching students, what to do if some kids puts a metal end of a protractor or compass, you know, into these sockets and electrocutes themselves. Or if they tip over a bottle of acid. Now what should we do? Because, you know, laboratories are dangerous places. And now kids being kids, you know, that, you know what they would do. And so, sooner or later, something's going to happen. So, we should be prepared. So, the one thing I remember the doctor telling me, he said, no matter what the injury looks like, don't sort of gasp and say, oh, that looks terrible, wow, that's awful, you know, your leg's hanging off, wow! Because that will put the little kid into shock. And he said, the shock, I remember him saying that the shock kills more people than the actual injury. It's an overreaction of the body. The blood vessels dilate, and the shock means that, you know, there's not enough blood going through, or something like that, I forget exactly. But anyway, he said the shock was one of the big killers. So he said, that is one time that you should all lie to your kids. You see, you know, the leg hanging off, said, oh, that's nothing, that'll be okay. And, you know, there's some truth to that. I remember just stepping on a nail in sort of Thailand, went right through me. Dirty old 4-inch nail. I didn't feel any pain at all. I just thought, oh, that's interesting. But the monk with me said, oh, that's terrible. And then it started hurting. And I told him off afterwards, no, do that. Have you ever had that experience? You know, something happens, oh, it's okay. And then so, oh, that's terrible. And then you really hurt. Or like nurses, doctors, please never say, this is going to hurt. It's really going to hurt. I'm terribly sorry, but this is one of the most painful procedures. That really helps. So in other words, because you're afraid, you tense up and it does get worse. So, afraid to die, of course we'll all die sometimes. And, you can't sort of, you must praise Venerable Kesari Dharmananda. You all know that story. That was so impressive. His doctor, I forget who his doctor was, but I remember just talking with him. He said, yeah, this happened. It was really shocked me. That when he was told that he was going to die, there's no way out, that the chief laughed. He said, the first person, the only person he's seen to laugh when he was told he was going to die. Now, what a wonderful thing that is. You're going to die anyway. It's not going to help me. So why not just laugh? Yay! Sometimes I tell people, suppose, you know, your doctor said you'd only got a week to live. How would you behave? Would you be afraid? Would you? Imagine, a simile. Imagine that on this retreat, that because of a really good sponsor, they said, we're going to give a prize to one person on this retreat, with their partner, with a friend. And the prize was a all-expensive paid trip to Los Angeles, to Hollywood. You'll fly first class on Malaysian Airlines, first class, with you and a friend, where you'll be taken to KLIA in a limo, chauffeur driven, like I'm expecting tomorrow, but I...
We disappointed. The last thing I wanted to be...
But anyway, once you get there, you'll be put into a 6-star hotel, you know, a penthouse suite for you and your friend. And every day you will have $1,000 each to go shopping, spending money. And in the evening, you can select your favorite TV star, or starlet, or rock star, or whatever, to have dinner with them every evening. Who would you choose? Would you choose Brad Pitt or Angelina Jolie or who's that? Taylor Swift? Guys? Yeah. Or who's the hot Justin Bieber? Am I too old? Who would you like to have dinner with? I don't have dinner. Lunch, okay. Except. I did accept a dinner invitation once. A dinner invitation once from Datuk Victor Wee on the 5th of May to the BGF celebratory dinner. The 30 years of BGF. But, suppose you had that and then a tour around the Hollywood sites during the daytime, meet all the stars and actually see some of the studios and just how the movies are made. And then at the end of that, after 2 weeks, then you fly back to KLIA, sort of first class, and then a chauffeur-driven car waiting for you with all of your shopping taken to your apartment or wherever you are. Just like a free dream holiday, the very best you could imagine. Now, would you like that? No, some people say no, but most people, they're just making up. Yes, of course they would like it. So, suppose that you won that, and you were going to leave KLIA, the trip was going to start in 1 week's time. Would you be excited? Would you be counting down the days? Only 6 days to go, 5 days to go. And the very last day, you probably wouldn't sleep at night. Tomorrow, I'm going to LA, first class, going to meet my favorite movie stars, really hot men, hot ladies, whatever you like, $1,000 free shopping every day. You'd be excited, wouldn't you? And some of you would say, oh, I can't wait to go. Now, what's better, that 2-week holiday or going to heaven? Which is better? Obviously going to a heaven realm. It's much better people, good-looking people up there than Brad Pitt. He's getting old now. Angelina Jolie's getting past it. And, and wouldn't heaven be nice? Would it be more enjoyable, more pleasant? So why is it when the doctor said, Madam, you've won the prize in 1 week's time. You're going to die and go to heaven. Wouldn't you actually say, I can't wait for a week, I want to go now. And only 3 days to go. Oh, come on. 2 days to go. 1 day I can't sleep the last night, which is usually common before you die. So why are people afraid of death? Especially if they know they've made such good karma, they can have a wonderful time. And also, get rid of this old sick body. Oh, it's a little tired and painful and difficult. So, if you understand that simile, why are you afraid to die? If you've been a bad girl, a naughty boy, then you might be afraid to die. Ooh, you know what's coming. Ooh. If you've been a good person, a kind person, which just about everybody in this room is, yeah, you've got a few faults, but, they're not that bad. So, it's amazing. Why are you afraid of dying? So, I can't wait, I can't wait. I know there's 4 years to go, 3 years, I can't make it 1 year. I think you understand the simile. Dear Ajahn Brahm, question, please share the meaning of your name. Sorry, tried to Google it but couldn't find it. Also, how did you get the name? You should know the meaning of my name. B for Buddhist, R for Roman Catholic, A for Anglican, H for Hindu, M for Muslim, yeah. Brahm. Bring everybody together. And if you're Jewish, I do apologize. So I was given it by my preceptor. I got stuck with it. What is the purpose of chanting? The purpose of chanting is to make sure that you're supposed to be keeping the precepts of noble silence. So if you didn't talk at all, the chanting at least keeps your voice box lubricated. But maybe it's not needed because you're talking anyway. So the purpose of chanting, some of the chants are really useful. And they teach good Dhamma. Like, I don't know how many times I've mentioned it in this retreat. Let them be contented and easily satisfied, not proud to demand, not proud or demanding in nature. And that's wonderful. It's contentment, simplicity. And it just, you know, just like a mother protects her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart will we cherish all beings. So, you know, you can relate to that. These are teachings which people can understand. Please explain the benefits of chanting if one doesn't understand the words in Pali, referring to those not translated by you during the retreat, i.e. the deep yellow colour paper we refer to each morning. Oh yeah, the itipiso and things like that. And sometimes they still have a power, and sometimes they have a power to focus your mind. And sometimes to focus your mind on a chant which you don't know the meaning of is sometimes really helpful. Because if you're focusing on the chant which is translated, sometimes your mind wanders off. Because, you know, it's something you understand, and you sort of make connections, and then you start thinking. But if it's a Pali chant, which meaning you don't know, then it's you have to work hard to focus on it, and it's also, you can't sort of proliferate with associations onto other ideas. Also, one of the reasons why, especially the monks, chant in a language which no one can understand, is because when I do make mistakes, no one knows. And I've done that before. Sometimes I work too hard, and sometimes I get tired, and there's one occasion I realized I was doing some chanting to bless a wedding. And by the time I started the chant, it was too late to do a U-turn. I was chanting the funeral chants. And I recognized it when it was too late to stop. And this lovely young couple, they were smiling and so kind of chanting. They didn't know what I was doing. So I finished it all. Oh, lovely chanting. And they're still together. It's amazing. Anyway, my teenage daughter fears ghosts and vampires. She could feel their existence during the night. What should she do? Also, is it real and can chanting work? She also said she cannot sleep when she chants. Why? You can't chant and sleep at the same time. But maybe after chanting can go to sleep. No, if would feel their presence of ghosts and vampires during the night. Well, you should ask her to ask the vampires, if they only fear them during the night, where do they go during the day? Like ghosts, where do they go during the daytime? Is it the fact they're up all night and they go to sleep during the day? If they go to sleep, where do they go to sleep? And also, what about the vampires? How do they live? What do they do during the night time? Do they have their friends? And if a nice boy vampire likes a nice girl vampire, do they get married and fall in love or something? Or when they kiss each other, does that mean that, you know, that the fangs go in? So, and ghosts, you know, does the ghost fall in love? It must be pretty lonely, you know, for a single girl ghost, just looking for someone to have friends with. And if they do fall in love and get married, do the ghosts have little baby ghosts? I always thought that one day I'll find a ghost, befriend it, and do an in-depth interview, which I can write up in the New Yorker or some interesting magazine. How it feels to be a ghost when no one loves you and everyone is scared of you. They must be very, very psychotic ghosts. And what can they eat anyway, or drink? If they feel like having a drink, it just goes right through them and out of them, makes a mess on the floor. But there was this one ghost story, and this was an old pub in England. This gentleman from Australia, you know, he was a hot day in England, and he went into one of these really old pubs. You know, they just really look quite attractive, you know, 300, 400, 500 years old, with the low ceilings and the wood. Probably haven't changed for centuries. But he was really surprised. They looked very attractive. The prices weren't too high. There was no one in the pub except the bartender. So he ordered a beer, sat down, and began drinking. And as soon as he started drinking, he heard a sound. And the sound said, "Very nice tie you're wearing today, sir." And he looked around. No one said that, but it was a hot day, so maybe imagination. Someone saying how nice his tie was. And then a few seconds later, he heard the sound again. And nice shoes, too. They really match. And who said that? And the bartender was a long way away. It wasn't him. So, again, maybe the heat. And so he had another swig of beer. "Oh, and a very snazzy jacket, very fashionable, sir." He heard that, it wasn't a bartender, there was no one in that pub at all. So he put his beer down and went to run out. It was supernatural. And as he was running out, so the bartender said, what's up, you haven't finished your beer yet. He said, "Look, there's a ghost in this pub." "What do you mean there's a ghost?" "Well, I heard this voice, I'm not mad, I heard it. Said a nice tie, and then he said a very nice pair of shoes and a very fashionable jacket you're wearing." And about, "Oh, that's the peanuts. They're complimentary." Somebody understands English. Complimentary. Complimentary means free. Also means they give compliments. They're complimentary. I think you have to be in England or in Manchester to know that joke. Okay. Now you get it. Okay. Oh, that really depresses me when. Okay, maybe it's not as good as the coffin one. That was very easy. What about the one about the Australian who went to visit the castle? No? Okay. So, I should have said that one. So, this Australian went to UK on holiday, and one of the things on their to-do list was to go and visit one of these old castles. They don't have castles like that here in Malaysia or in Australia. Really ancient. 800, 900 years old. And some of the things which happened in the bottom of those castles, in the dungeons. Really nasty torture and killing. And wow, if you're going to find a ghost anywhere, that's where you'll find them. In the dungeons of these ancient castles. But she had to go there anyway to have a look. So she was with the guide going down into the dungeons. And usually she wasn't afraid, but this time the whole place was so spooky. Every floorboard she stood on. Every door they open. And every window they passed, which was always, you know, no glass in it. That's called sound effects. So even though she'd never ever seen a ghost before, and she never really believed in them, still she was scared. She couldn't wait to get up those old stone stairs into the fresh air. And she breathed a sigh of relief, and she asked the guide, "Are there any ghosts in this castle?" And the guide said, "No, no ghosts in this castle. In all the years I've lived here, there's never been no ghosts." And she said, "How long have you lived here?" "Over 300 years." "Be careful, you don't know who the ghost is. It may be the one sitting next to you. It's a few people I can't remember they were here the first day." Nah, ghosts can't come close when there's a good mic around. What or how can one do to remove the boys, the something of past and future, the bugs or something? Even if the bags are the bags. Even if the bags, like the shopping bags, are stored in a bin, the bin would eventually become full and need to be emptied. And not all bins have a hole underneath until they are unless they are defective. So, what can do to remove the bags of past and future? You just leave them there, and there's something called the rubbish truck will come if you leave them there long enough. That's what they say in the airport. Bags left unattended will be taken away. So all your shopping bags of past and future, take them to the airport, and they will be removed without your knowing. Anyway, I'll just make this up as I go along, as you probably understand. So, but when you remove the bags of past, and you put them down, at the very least, you have a rest. And you'll understand what it's like not to be carrying the past and carrying the future. And if you want to do that shopping bag similarly, or if others, you know, sometimes when we have lots and lots and lots of stuff, and that's why that, please don't give me things. Because if I have things, I've got to try and give them away to somebody, because you can't take them back on the aircraft. So I try and give them away. Or we have auctions or sales or something to share things around. But please don't give monks anything. I'm a monk who wants for nothing. So if you want to give me anything, give me nothing. So somebody actually did that recently. They gave me a nice little box. It was the end of the retreat which I did in London. A nice little box, wrapped up, and when I opened it, it was empty. Wow, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. That's what I always wanted. Nothing. Yesterday you spoke of five hindrances meditation. However, only doubt and wanting and not wanting were mentioned. What about the other three hindrances? Hang on, you can't count. Doubt, wanting and not wanting. Those not wanting and not wanting, the first two hindrances, doubt are the fifth. So the two in the middle. How does one overcome those hindrances? Usually the restlessness and the sloth and torpor. Sorry? Yeah, the restlessness and sloth and torpor. Sorry? Ill will is not wanting. You want to get rid of something. So that's the second hindrance. But the sloth and torpor and restlessness, that is the result of wanting or not wanting. You tire the mind out. I did mention that, the sloth and torpor, mentioned when I was either really asleep or I was restless. And I couldn't find that midway. When I really put some effort in, broke through my sloth and torpor, and then I was restless. Calm the restlessness down, then fell asleep. It was always because of wanting. And the solution was that when you understand that the two parts of the mind, the doer and the knower, when you do something, you try and control things, want things, or try and get rid of things, that tires you out. You get sloth and torpor. And if you put some more wanting in, you just get restless. So to find the middle way, no wanting, no not wanting, just letting things be. Loving kindness, if you like. Open the door of your heart to this, no matter what it is, and your energy starts to return. Thanks for your teachings. Look forward to see you again. You picked up the bag of the future again. So, who knows? The future is uncertain. During meditation, can our mind be influenced by the dark side? Yes, it can, because I was actually in Hong Kong. I gave a sort of a presentation with Professor Richard Gombrich. And as we introduced one another, I said, I studied at Cambridge, Professor Gombrich studied at Oxford. Cambridge is the light blues, Oxford is the dark blues. He is from the dark side. And he laughed. And he says, oh, now we have the lighter side of academia. And of course, no, that I made it light. Funny. But the spirits, no, they can't influence you. Not a person who's on this retreat. They can't influence you. The spirits. Of course, the lighter spirits, like jinn, that's pretty light, isn't it? Transparent. So obviously I made that joke before about alcohol being a spirit. But the spirits, the ghosts, they can only make you scared. And they can actually be quite helpful sometimes if you cultivate the spirits. There was... oh, lots of really... This is real ghost stories. There was I think you all know the tsunami ghost? Okay. Yes, tsunami ghost, a wonderful story. This other one was a couple in an elderly people's home. And, you know, the guy, you know, he'd lost his wife a long time ago. The girl, you know, her husband had died a long time ago. Children didn't visit all that often. In fact, for the guy, he didn't have any children in Australia. They were over in England somewhere. So, you know, the two of them sort of bonded. You know, they were too old to get married and have, you know, sex or anything like that. They were just, you know, really good friends. And he would help her out with somebody repairing things. She was sometimes, cook him a meal. So they were really good friends in their late years. And he'd always told her that he had no relations in Australia. But he had, I think, one son over in England somewhere. And then he died one night. And, you know, she was the only friend which he had. So she looked through his things to see if he can find a telephone number or at least some contact number of the son in England somewhere. There was no contact there at all. So she felt very, very guilty that she didn't ask. And so someone had died and no one could contact the nearest relation. So, one night, soon after the death, she was in her bed, and she clearly was woken up because somebody was stroking her cheek. And of course, she thought, it's an intruder. Some person was trying to assault her. So she turned on a bedside light. All the windows were locked. The door was locked. So, you know, she could remember that. It felt very nice, but it was a real person. She wasn't dreaming it. And then, in old tradition, she had a tissue paper all folded by the side of her bed just in case she needed it at night time. And the tissue paper lifted up and fell to the ground. There's no breeze. There's no wind in there. No aircon. No fan. It was still, but it rose up and fell to the ground. And she opened it. She said she knew what was happening. She opened it, and inside was the telephone number, which she rang straight away and there was this man's son. He wrote it on there as a ghost, so that she would be so worried, and so his son could be told that he passed away. Real ghost stories are really nice. Real ghost stories. Complimentary, bump, bump, bump. That was just jokes. Would you like to continue talking about regarding total free will? Or no total free will? Unfortunately, I can't, because it's not under my power. I've got no free will to talk about that. So, the story which I will say is a story which I invented just so many years ago. It must be about 20 years ago. And somebody took that story and took the main part and never gave me any recognition on any royalties. Really mean. Because I wanted to explain what, you know, will actually is. Will is one of the most important parts of who you think you are. And that's one of the reasons why in our societies we really struggle to get our freedom of choice. So, you know, our will is our most prized personal possession. But the point is that very few people know what the will is. And sometimes the will is, sometimes this, I don't know why my will is so stupid. Sometimes in life you're having a very nice time, and you know, you want to slow down and really appreciate it as much as you can, and then your will gets in the way and just makes it all go wrong. And sometimes, sometimes you are sick, or you are having pain. Sometimes you will, I have a problem, I need to go to the toilet, can you please stop talking now? But your will doesn't do what you want it to. And I gave the similar, it's like sitting in the seat of a bus, like, you know, going to the airport or something. You're sitting in the seat of the bus, and you look through the window, and you see some very beautiful, you know, land and mountains and beautiful sunny day and just lovely views and waterfalls. And you say, well, I want to stop and enjoy this. And what does your bus driver, the will, do? Accelerates. So all the good, happy times in your life don't last that long. And then sometimes you're going through the toxic waste dumps of life, the nuclear disaster zones. You look through the window and it's really, really nasty and disgusting and horrible. You tell your bus driver, come on, get out of here as soon as you can. This is terrible. I don't want to stay here another minute. And what does your bus driver do? Stops and parks. And you get really upset at your stupid will. You know, you never do anything right. I'm having a nice retreat, nice and peaceful, and I start thinking these stupid fantasies. I'm having a lovely, I'm just about to get very peaceful, and then I start sneezing. Or whatever, I'm having a wonderful time, then I get sick. This is my holidays. Why can't I get sick when I'm at work? It takes some more time off. And so, sometimes the life doesn't go the way it should do, and your will is the problem. So what do? You try and teach the will. Know how to have some wisdom and compassion. So teach the will to be wiser. And that's why many people come to religions or come to meditation or come to therapies. And you don't think your will is a problem, it just needs to be tuned up and made to be able to do things wisely. So when you're having difficult times, the will can actually get you out faster instead of parking. When you're having a wonderful time, really enjoying yourself, the world can actually slow down so you can really appreciate and savour the beautiful things of life. So what happens? The world is so hard to teach. And so, one day you decide the only way you can instruct your will is actually to find out what it is. You have to find the bus driver's seat. Where you sit, who your will is. And eventually, through meditation, you go to the front of the bus, where the bus driver's seat is, to find out who's driving this vehicle called your body and mind, your life. And when you get to the bus driver's seat, it's not what you expected. There's no one there. The bus driver's seat is empty. The driverless bus. And what happened? I invented that phrase, the driverless vehicle. Google, Tesla, all these other people, they stole my ideas. If I'd have patented it, then I'd be rich. I'd be able to build not just the next story of the BGF, but the three more stories with a helipad on top, so I can come and teach at any time straight from Australia in my helicopter. No more KLIA. But I missed my opportunity. But anyway, the driverless bus. Once you realize that your bus is empty, there is no will there, what happens? You sit down in your seat and you stop complaining. There's no one to complain to. No wants, no aversions. You're at peace. There's no one to argue with. End of problem. Anyway, what is the difference between right intention and right effort? Right intention is renunciation, kindness and gentleness. Letting go, being kind, being gentle. Nekama sankapa, awayapada sankapa, and ahingsaka sankapa. It's not really intention, it's motive, where you're coming from. And the right effort is efforts to renounce, to let go as well. Whatever it takes to stop unwholesome things, to prevent them from coming up, to have wholesome states of mind. Does effort create wholesome states of mind? It just makes you tired and frustrated. And development of good states. And if you've tried on this retreat developing nice and peaceful states of mind through effort. Effort is the wrong word. Vayama. And sometimes they call it virya. Virya is sometimes called energy, but it really comes from a Pali word, vira, which means the hero. So it's heroic efforts, almost like sacrifice, willing to give up everything. That's heroic. That's the type of vayama and virya which is needed. Uh-oh. Dear Ajahn, sexual misconduct is breaking precepts. However, some people see sex as disgusting conduct. However, if two individuals are not married and have casual sex, is it breaking precepts? If one has a regular casual sex with different partners, is it okay? Can we get the handwriting expert? No, I'll never do that to you. I'm just too kind. So, the precepts is sexual misconduct is usually with somebody who you are either coercing or they're either not mentally or physically able to refuse. In other words, it's coercion. Or if it is with somebody else's partner. Because all these things cause a lot of harm and hurt. It's also with anyone in a teaching position who abuses their position of authority with their disciples. So that sometimes happens with monks and even nuns and teachers in schools who do abuse their position of authority to have sex with their disciples. That is a criminal offence in Australia, and hopefully it is here as well. Even though I've been a very good monk for many, many years, in Australia, I have to have a working with children card. So if there's any children who come into one of my talks who's under 16 and sitting in the back, even if I don't even talk to them, if I don't have the working with children card, the Buddhist Society of Western Australia, they get fined about $50,000 or something, and I get fined as well. Couldn't pay the fine, but because, you know, of what's happened before with some priests, that is so hard now. So I don't mind. It's just every year you have to, no, every 2 years, have to go, usually send things up for a police check to make sure I've got no criminal record, especially with any accusations from children. Otherwise, I wouldn't be allowed to do my job. So it's very, very clear, because sometimes the trust has been broken by people in authority. Because of that, it's destroyed so much of people's lives, and also so many people's faith in people of authority. That's why they have the Me Too campaign, you know, over in United States and many other countries, where women have been really abused, you know, by people in authority, your bosses, or, you know, famous film stars, or priests. And so that's one of the reasons. That is sexual misconduct. Very clear and simple. And so that is where, you know, the sexual act between a consenting couple, you know, can be a pretty wonderful act. You know, I was a lay person before. You know, when I was a lay person, I had a girlfriend and we slept together, you know, so it was fine. You know, if, it wasn't casual because, you know, we were sort of committed together for a while. So, in the end, I think I was very happy that I had that experience. So, at least, you know, something of what you're talking about. Otherwise, I mean, it's just hypocrite. What did you know? But casual sex with different partners, I think that's just missing out on something. And you get, you know, the sexual act coming together with another person, it's sometimes it's very sticky and very sort of emotionally entangling. And if it has many partners too soon, it does get very, very, very messy. So because of that, it is usually just, you know, one partner. I know in the old days, I'm not quite sure of Malaysian Chinese culture, but you know that sometimes, no, wait till we get married. But you know, also there's a good argument to say that if you're going to buy an expensive car, you're going to lay out all that commitment of funding, you have to pay it off for many years. You know, test drive before you buy. That's putting it grossly, but sometimes you can see the reason behind that. You know, actually just to see what it's like living with that person. Because, you know, if you wear makeup and when you go out with a guy, you know, they're always really nice and very nice, oh yeah, I'm a very good person. But you don't know what they're really like until you actually live with them. So sometimes there is some logic behind this. You know, it's just disgusting. It's very difficult sometimes. And it's wonderful to know there's, you know, more to life than just sex. There's, you know, other pleasures which are very amazing, just the beautiful pleasures of inspiration, of giving, of, you know, other forms of love, and also just of deep meditation and peace. So, you know what you're doing, and don't harm anybody else, and don't harm yourself. I'm sure you've faced many challenges as a Buddhist monk in the past. What keeps you going? Well, at least, you know, I got employment and I got a secure place. So in this very difficult world, you know, just who knows when you get it. You might get the sack. But I haven't got the sack. There's nothing to sack me from. And even if I did get accused of something I didn't do and I went to jail. Oh, yes. Because in jail, you can go and retreat. No one bothers you. And you don't have to worry about your food. At least they give you some food. So if I went to jail, I would actually volunteer to go in solitary confinement. A retreat. Wouldn't that be wonderful? And they say, we're going to take away TV. Yes. And not see any other prisoners. Yes. So it'd be nice and peaceful. And that actually did happen to this... Oh. We've got to finish now. That did. I'll try not many more stories. This is like, well, I don't know. Probably I will break that rule. But anyway, that this monk, Chao Khun Tape Sidimuni, he was the abbot of Wat Mahathat. This was just before I came to Thailand, and a very good monk, meditator, very, very simple living. He was the number two. The next in line to be the Sangha Raja of Thailand, the head monk of Thailand. The number three, the next in line after this, what Chakun Thep Sidimuni really, 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 really wanted to be the head monk of Thailand. Obviously for the wrong reasons. And so he thought, this number two monk is just so good, so popular, and so fit and healthy. You know, I'll wait forever to become the head monk of Thailand. So I have to do something about this. So what this number three monk, he set this number two monk up by recording many of his talks. And, you know, you say so much that sooner or later it can be interpreted. If you take this section, this section, this section, he was accused of being a communist. And in those days, you know, throughout the whole of Southeast Asia, being a communist was, you know, you went to jail for that. So, he was accused of being a communist, he was taken to court, and he was so peaceful, never really tried to defend himself, was just too passive. And so he was convicted and put in jail. And if you're a monk put in jail in Thailand, you know, you have to take off your brown robes and wear white. But he still thought of himself as a monk, so he continued to, you know, keep his head shaved, and people would give him food. And after 2 or 3 years, a strange thing happened. The old Sangharaja passed away, and so the number three monk was installed as the head monk of Thailand, and was going to the old Don Mueang airport in the north of Bangkok, before the new one was built, obviously, and in a motorcade, because this is VIP. So there's a motorcade, and a couple of police cars in front, a couple of police cars behind, and the Sangharaja in the middle car. And on the opposite side of the road, a car lost control, went over the median strip, and smashed into the middle car, exactly where the Sangharaja was sitting, and killed him, dead. And all the other people in the car, the drivers, the police, they were totally unharmed. Only one person died, and that was the Sangharaja. And when that happened in Thailand, I thought, this is unique, strange. How come there was an accident and only one person got hurt and killed? So they thought there must be some karma behind this. So they started investigating, and they actually found that he was the one who set up this Tape Sidimuni unfairly, unjustly, and sent him to jail. So immediately the number two monk was given a pardon. And went back to the monastery, wore his robes, and kept all his reins. And when they asked him, are you angry and upset that you were put in jail for something you didn't do? He said, no, no, no. This is one of the best times of my monk life, he said. He said, I had a retreat for 2 years. I could relax, meditate, catch up on my reading, do a little bit of research. Because, you know, people still looked after me in jail. They said, a wonderful time in my life. Thank you, thank you, thank you for putting me in jail for this time. And as a senior monk, I can understand why he said that. Not having to go all over the world and to give talks and go back to Bodhinyana Monastery and look at the politics and stuff in organizations. He was just so free and peaceful. So he really enjoyed that. But there's no way he would be the Sangharaja after. He said, no, give it to someone else. I just like my peace and quiet. That's a true story, Chakum Tape Sidimuni. When you are half awake, a present Buddhist leader pointed his finger at your face for the wrong reasons and later on intended to put you to sleep. When other monks pointed out the leader's fault, he refused to apologize. Are you still giving talk to this leader for the benefits of other devotees? Which leader is that? I don't know. When you are half awake, a present Buddhist leader pointed his finger at your face for the wrong reasons, and later on intended to put you to sleep. Don't know what this is about, anyway. When other monks pointed out the leader's fault, he refused to apologize. Are you still giving talk to this leader for the benefit of other devotees? Ooh, I don't know what that's all about. That's really... anyway... If that was the case, a Buddhist leader pointed his finger at your face for the wrong reasons, and later on intended to put you to sleep. I don't know why they want to put you to sleep for it. That means just euthanizing you? I don't know. But sometimes we say, intended to put you to sleep. Sometimes we don't know people's intentions. Sometimes we can guess their intentions. But, you know, only they would know why they do things. And Other monks pointed out the leader's fault. If they did point out the leader's fault, you don't point out the leader's fault, especially not in public. You take them aside, you start talking to them and say, why did you do that? They may have to give a very good reason. Oh, you know, because this, that and the other. I said, yes, but it can be misinterpreted. And because you have to be very careful about your actions being misunderstood, that's why a monk has to be very, very careful what they do. Like, for example, there was this one time I was teaching in prisons. Are you okay? Getting a bit late? Okay. I was giving some teachings in a prison in the town of Bunbury. And the only way I could do that was go just for lunch. And then the afternoon was free. I went on the train. And I'd be looked after the night time in the Catholic parish house. You know, they're giving a room there to sleep for the night and in the morning get in the train and go back to Bodhinyana Monastery. But the afternoon was free for me. So one afternoon, I went to Bunbury Beach. It's really calm, peaceful. No one was around. And it's a lovely place to meditate. So I sat on the beach, crossed my legs, and started meditating. I was meditating for a couple of hours. And when I opened my eyes, you know, just coming out, nice, peaceful meditation next to the beach, I opened my eyes and, oh, what have I got myself into? Because I looked to my left, and there was this 17-year-old blonde in a bikini sitting right next to me on the left. And I turn the other side, there's another really beautiful raven-headed girl in a bikini, 17 years old, sitting on my other side. And I thought, if someone had a mobile phone, I'd be dead. Because the reason was, and the reason I know they were both 17 years of age, because that day, I never realized this, it was the last day of school when they finished their final exam of the session in year 12, grade 12. They just finished their last exam in the afternoon. And what do? If you live next to the beach in Australia, get into your bathers, bikinis and celebrate. Free at last, exams are over. So they, you know, changed into their bikinis, and they saw this fellow, me, brown robes, bald head, just sitting there, absolutely motionless. And they were really fascinated. You know, how can you actually do that? You know, sit so still, and don't even notice, you know, people coming and going. And so they both sat on either side of me, just waiting patiently for me to come out of meditation so they could have a talk with me about Buddhism and meditation. They were really impressed. As for me, honestly, I was scared. It was totally innocent. I've got to go now, really. Because otherwise, if someone had seen me and photographed me, what would you say? It was an innocent explanation. But that's one of the reasons why, as a monk or as a nun, anyone in a position of authority or power, it's not just your intentions, but what it looks like to others. So I must always remember that. That's all I can say about that. You don't know what happened, why. Sometimes people get misunderstood. What is the difference between states of samadhi and that of falling asleep? Okay, I think somebody actually asked me this privately. What it is in falling asleep, you're not mindful. You're not aware, you've got no happiness, no joy, no power. But in samadhi, you're really awake. Fully awake, much more awake than you are now. Focused, and it's like when you put that magnifying glass in front of the sun. Instead of being spread all over the place and being dull, it's very powerful, it can burn. So, no, obviously in a good way. So that's where you have a lot of power. How to enjoy without wanting or greed? Usually, when a pleasant feeling arises, liking or greed follows. So if we enjoy the nimitta, does this allow wanting to creep up on us to destabilize the nimitta? Yes, it does. The wanting destabilizes it, so you soon understand that. So you put your mindfulness and awareness into keeping the causes Correct. In other words, just not wanting anything. And then because you're not wanting anything, you're content letting go, then the nibbata gets stronger and stronger and stronger. The enjoyment which arises from letting go, from freedom. Oh, this is the naughty one about farting. Ajahn can suggest any meditation place in Chiang Mai, Thailand. Sadhu. It's been a long time since I've been free wandering around Thailand, so I don't really know where to go in Thailand. I do know Ajahn Ganha because he's a good friend. Other than that, I don't know where to go in Thailand. So, find out for yourself where to go in Thailand around Chiang Mai. Should celibacy be practiced by a married couple already have kids in order to practice meditation successfully? You can still develop deep meditation even if you're not celibate. Just like I mentioned, I hope I don't offend anybody, but you know, when I was with a girlfriend, I had a beautiful sex with her, and then a week later just went to a retreat and got into really deep meditation. And obviously I wasn't celibate at the time, but I could still get into deep meditation. But you know what happened afterwards? That was, you know, pretty much the end of such relationships. Because, you know, why just have sex when you can have a much deeper and peaceful and beautiful and longer state of bliss? So, but anyway, you're a married couple, so remember, when you're married, it's not about you, it's not about your partner. Who's it about? Yes, you have to work together and find out what we want to do, not what you want to do. Dear His Holiness Ajahn Brahm, not His Holiness, His Roundness Ajahn Brahm, do non-returners have wanting for five material forms and immaterial forms if she has eradicated sense desire? Sense desire is the desire and attachment and the craving for the five sense realm. So if you let go of the body and all its happiness and cravings and wantings, things like sex or food, then the pleasure of the mind is something else, far more delightful. So yes, if you are a non-returner, you may still have the attachment, the joy to the deep pieces of jhana. That is an attachment. It's one of those attachments which still remains when you're a non-returner. But I think many of you will be sad. People who are in the deva realms, they don't die. They just fade, disappear. Nor do they get born. They just arise, fully formed. There are no children up in heaven realms. No one running about in the lobby area, screaming and shouting, going past even the residence places and just trying to meditate. So it's a heaven realm, because you know, no schools, you just arise, fully formed, mature, and then you start to fade away, disappear. Chuta, you fall from that place, you don't die. Anyway, actually these last questions are pretty easy ones, so. This is the very last question. Dear Ajahn, if merits and virtues can't be transmitted to others, how about offering we make then? Merits and virtues can't be transmitted to others. Of course they can be transmitted to others. Merits and virtues, as I mentioned, I think today, your merits and virtues, they'll be transmitted to everybody you meet and see on your way back home, on the way to work, just the very fact you're a kind, peaceful person. One more person, you don't sometimes realize it, just how much you've grown and developed in peace and wisdom over these 8 or 9 days. One of the reasons is because we'd all been growing the same way. You know that I never knew the moment when I got fat. I never woke up and went, you're fat, you were thin yesterday. it just sort of creeps up on you. Little by little by little by little. So you don't notice it. Just like your wisdom and compassion and your stillness, your progress in meditation, just day by day, you don't realize just how much you are making of peace and being kinder. But your family members and your friends, people you live with and work with, they haven't seen you for a week or 8 days. So you can see my virtues and merits I've been transmitting to each one of you for the last 8 days. Has it worked? You bet it has. So that is how virtues are transmitted. Sometimes we think it has to be some psychic thing, transmitting virtues to the other side of the world, but please don't try transmitting virtues to me. That would be like sending a donation to Bill Gates. Bill Gates won't even notice it. He's got too much money. So please transmit your virtues and merits to people who really, really need them. And just because that's the last question, anybody who does feel gratitude and they come up to me and say, "Thank you so much, you've helped me so much, Ajahn Brahm. What can I give you?" That is missing the point. If this is what Ajahn Chah said to me, he said, "If you really want to pay off your debt of gratitude," said Ajahn Chah, "you have to go and help somebody else. And when you've helped somebody else and they come up to you and say, 'Thank you so much, you really helped me, what can I get you?' I say, 'No. Now you're in debt to me. You've got to go and help another person.' And that way, the good karma, the merits, get transmitted and transferred on and on and on without end. If I've helped you and you give me something back, it's finished. It's even, sama-sama. But if I say, 'Now you've got to help somebody else,' that means the gift of Dharma always continues on and on and on and on, and on without end." And I like that. Ajahn Chah, he was only 4 years at school, but my goodness, he was wise. He made all those Nobel laureates and professors I grew up with look so stupid in Cambridge. Honestly, that was really amazing. Okay, any other comments or questions before we finish off? Okay, we can do the sharing of merits now, just because it's a nice tradition. It brings my mind back to my parents and grandparents and all the people who really looked after me. And of course Ajahn Chah, even though he doesn't really need any. Idamenyatina hotu sukita hontu yatayo idame yatinang hotu sukhita hontu yatayo idamme yatinang hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. A nice big one for the end. Okay, but there is still meditation tomorrow morning. And even now it's only 12 minutes to 9, to 10. The night is still young. Now have a break if you need to. And the morning is, what's the schedule again? It's for 6 o'clock chanting. Where's it gone? Okay, 6 o'clock chanting and then 7:30 breakfast. And then afterwards, what have we done? A closing. Closing photo. And where's that? Here? Okay, here's start of breakfast. Come down here. Okay, so closing photo and last words. Very good. Excellent.